Well, good afternoon, everybody. It's Kevin Stevenson. Thanks for joining me on this episode of I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. And today, my guest is John Hawkins. John took the helm as president and CEO of the Texas Hospital Association on January the 1st in 2022. And he's the organization's sixth CEO since its inception in 1930. And I thought it would be really interesting to have John on for a variety of reasons, but primarily because I know a lot of people really don't know what state hospital associations do and how they serve the hospitals and health systems of their respective states. And so with that, John, welcome to I Don't Care.
Great. I appreciate the opportunity. Great to see you today.
Well, thanks, John. I appreciate it. And it's great to see you, too. Tell my audience just a little bit about you and kind of your path to become president and CEO of THA.
Yeah, so I came down to the University of Texas about 40 years ago and got a government degree and started working over at the Capitol. We could actually do an internship as part of our credit. And so I always had an interest in politics and public policy. And I ended up working for the Sunset Advisory Commission and actually managed the review of our Health and Human Services enterprise. Probably it would have been several Sunset reviews ago back then. And that really gave me an interest in the way the state kind of manages healthcare, the Medicaid program and the regulatory scheme as well. And so when my predecessor at THA in the government relations group actually made the jump over to the medical association, he encouraged me to talk to THA. I'd always kind of envisioned myself staying on the inside, with my policy background, but really jumping to THA was a great opportunity because I believe healthcare really is probably the richest area for public policy and to be able to make a difference in public policy. And so I managed the government relations team for about 18 years. And then when our previous CEO retired, I put my hat in the ring to become CEO. And I will have been CEO, I guess, 4 years in November. So it's been an easy transition for me, obviously, knowing the issues and knowing the membership.
That's great. Yeah. And I know THA represents about 85% of the acute care hospitals and health systems across Texas, over 400,000 healthcare workers. So, you know, everybody knows Texas is a really big state, right? And there are all sorts of hospitals of sizes and governance and issues and all that. Talk to me a little bit about how you navigate the representation of all of those hospitals as you and your team seek to serve what we do.
Yeah, so a little bit about THA. We are the statewide trade association, represent the majority of the acute care hospitals in the state. We've also got a pretty significant behavioral health component as well, which I think is important. We represent everyone, urban, rural, not-for-profit, government, investor-owned. Waco is not like the Valley, is not like El Paso, so you've got really regional diversity as well. So really our job is to be a convener. You know, I tell people all the time that the legislature is not really good at solving problems. If they do try to solve your problem, you're probably not going to like the outcome. So our job is to really get out in the field, talk to you all about kind of what's keeping you up at night, figure out if there is a regulatory or a legislative fix to that, and then actually convene, you know, as broad a group as we can to talk about what common solutions can be, and then actually go over across the street and deliver a solution, you know, talk to the legislature about why it's a problem and why we believe we've got a solution and actually try to bring them a solution. So really, from our perspective, it's better for us to have a robust kind of a policy development process, a good vetting within our Council on Policy Development, which helps feed policies up to our governing board. But if we don't really do that early work to make sure we can get everybody more or less on the same page, we're not going to be successful across the street, or we might create some solution that's ultimately not going to benefit everyone. So that's really just being a convener, making sure we've got diversity of membership on our policy committee, on our board, looking at governance. We've got lots of policy committees that help us drill down on different aspects: finance, patient safety and quality, trauma and EMS. Those policy committees help us kind of solve technical issues that we know are out there in our hospitals.
Sure. And while I think most people that are familiar with state hospital associations recognize that you are that advocate for us at the state capitals from a policy perspective, THA has a lot of other services that I think my audience would be surprised to hear that you provide for hospitals. If you don't mind touching on just a few of those.
Yeah. So obviously, advocacy really, I think, is the most important. But we try to serve our members in many different other ways. So we've got a robust education department. So we provide an educational program, whether that's a webinar or in-person meetings or even our annual conference in the fall where we bring people together. And so, again, we're not trying to recreate the wheel. There's probably you could Google 500 law firms that could do a webinar on HIPAA compliance. But for example, we just passed the Life of the Mother Act this session, dealing with some clarification around the abortion issue. And so that's an opportunity for us and the medical association to actually do training to our members and to clinicians post session about what's included in that law. So education's important. We've got a foundation that can actually receive grants. So we've got a patient safety organization where we convene our members to, in a safe space to talk about ways to improve patient safety and quality. We've got a peer review network where we have a pool of physicians that can help with peer review. We have a insurance company, a member-owned insurance company that we're affiliated with that provides a variety of insurance, medical liability, among others, for a lot of our smaller hospitals. We have a vendor affinity program where we try to identify vendors that can help our hospitals with different solutions are looking for strategic partnerships there as well. And so, it really is kind of a whole range of services, just looking to, help meet our members' needs going forward.
Okay. Well, let's go back to that main thrust of what the hospital association does, and that's representing us incredibly well from an advocacy standpoint in Austin. So I pulled up the 2025 state policy priorities for Texas hospitals. Let me go through those real quick, and let's just touch on some of those. We'll start state budget, financial stability, workforce, healthcare access and coverage, behavioral health access, removing red tape, limiting access to care, and public health and equity. So floor is open to you, John. Let's touch on a few of those or all of those, whichever ones that you would like to address.
Yeah, no, that's I appreciate you bringing that document up, because really that is our attempt going into session. I was just looking, it's interesting. There were a little over 9,000 bills filed last session, and about almost 1,200 ended up passing. And we ended up tracking almost 1,900 of those bills. So obviously, you and your listeners know how complex healthcare is, and hospitals are probably one of the most highly regulated entities out there, whether it's the payment, Medicaid, Medicare, or the regulatory requirements, physical plant, patient safety and quality, and then of course all the like yourself, licensed professionals that work in our facilities, and they have all the issues related to their licensure and scope of practice and things of that nature. So, we know there's 1,900 issues out there we're worried about. Most of those are not good ideas, in spite of what their author thinks they are. So a lot of times we're either trying to improve them or bottle them up. But we create that document to really kind of put the big bucket items out there. And so, you know, obviously the financial stability is always at the top of the list. And, you know, we primarily focus on state advocacy, but we also keep an eye on Washington. We work very closely with the American Hospital Association. So obviously the Medicaid program is really the most important going forward. You know, that is a shared federal state program, but the feds really kind of set out the parameters of the program, but the state actually does have state legislature has a lot of latitude around kind of services beyond just the minimum services that are required, certainly payment rates, things of that nature. So making sure Medicaid is fully funded is always very important to us. Also making sure we the trauma system is funded. We've had some real success over the last 15 years or so in actually creating a dedicated funding source for trauma services. And so we want to make sure that's robust. And obviously we are also partner with the RACs and with the EMS community in that as well. And certainly, unfortunately, you know, these most recent disasters just, you know, show us once again why it's important to have a good disaster management system in the state. So, you know, those I think are really the biggest bucket from a direct funding impact on hospitals. But the other big bucket, so that's kind of, you know, we call it Article 2, which is the budget. But Article 3 is very important too, and that's the workforce pipeline.
I was hoping you would get to that.
Yeah. So obviously coming out of COVID, you know, we had a nursing shortage before COVID, which we've worked really hard to help deal with. You know, COVID, you know, kind of laid those challenges bare. We've also worked, you know, very closely with the Medical Association to make sure we're funding the physician pipeline, particularly on the making sure we've got clinical rotations out there for our medical students. So that continues to be very important. And then, you know, post-COVID now, just allied health generally, you know, lab techs, phlebotomists, you know, those folks can be a choke point as well. And so, you know, two sessions ago coming out of COVID, we really kind of went hard to the hoop and asked the legislature to help shore up the behavioral health or the workforce pipeline. And they did that. And I think we're continuing to build on that.
Well, and John, I'm really glad that you brought up the point that we had a nursing shortage before COVID, because I think a lot of people don't really realize that. You know, I've been doing this podcast for 6 years now, and right before COVID, I had a couple of national nursing leaders on separate podcasts, and they both said the same thing. And one made that comment before we even knew what COVID was. The other one was about, 2 months into COVID. But they both said the same thing, you know, that the nursing supply is drying up because there are fewer faculty members in the nursing schools, number one. And then post the beginning of COVID, that nursing leader said, you know, people are finding out that nursing is very physically taxing and mentally taxing as well. And so fewer people were looking to get into the industry. But it was really interesting that she said, you know, as we navigate this initial round of COVID, and of course here, you know, in Central Texas, we had 4 rounds of COVID over an extended period of time. But she said, nurses won't retire. They won't leave because they don't want to leave their colleagues in the midst of something like this. But she said, mark my words, 3 to 6 months after that last wave, you'll see a huge bolus of nurses leave the industry. She was dead on. And that is something that we at my hospital, we have faced for a good 2.5 to 3 years, having an adequate supply of nursing. And then, again, appreciate what you said, really the true post-COVID impact on allied health, because it's kind of the same thing. You know, people are finding out, hey, healthcare is a difficult industry for a lot of reasons, and it's been really difficult to try to recruit those people to whether it be the therapies or imaging techs or whatever. And so now I think it's incumbent upon all of us to, number one, talk up, the mission of healthcare, the calling of healthcare. But I think the other thing is to really start going after the kids in high school or even younger to make sure that they recognize that this is truly a very noble profession where you get to help people. And as, if we can continue to instill that, through either our local efforts or certainly through THA, hopefully we can make a real impact.
Yeah, that's a great point. A couple things there. I was actually on a panel with a couple weeks ago with the Texas Association of Community Colleges. And so the other thing the legislature has done is they've changed the funding structure for community colleges to actually make that performance based. And so if those community colleges can identify credentials of value, they're not capped in their funding. And if they're willing to build those programs, the legislature has to step up and fund them. And so obviously healthcare, all of our, those areas you just mentioned are all clearly credentials of value. So so they're going to be a great partner with us. And that's exactly what we talked about, is that it's incumbent on all of us to be out in high schools, even maybe I would say some of these tech jobs, maybe in middle schools, not too early, to show these folks careers in healthcare. The credentials are generally stackable. So even if you start out, in more of a tech job and you decide you want to go into nursing and even medicine at some point, you're generally not throwing that work away. So appreciate you bringing that up. And you're right. THA has a clear role in making sure we're talking about that issue out in the field.
Yeah. Well, another issue that you brought up that I do want to explore a little bit more is behavioral health access. You did say that you went to UT. I won't hold that against you since I'm a Baylor grad twice over. But, I remember when, and we're about the same age, I remember when we were kids, there were a number of state hospitals for folks that had behavioral health and mental issues. And many of those, most of those closed. We do not have an adequate supply of beds in the state of Texas for behavioral health issues. And more are closing every day. And really we're finding that the impact on our emergency departments from, people with significant behavioral health issues coming in and our not having really a place to send those people has become a true burden on the entire system. So talk a little bit about what THA is doing from an advocacy standpoint on that whole behavioral health access issue.
Yeah, it's appreciate you bringing that up. So it's interesting when I first started at THA, we didn't really talk about behavioral health much. And particularly when we did talk about funding, we said we need to worry about acute care and the rest will just kind of take care of itself. But, I think, several things happened. Obviously, with the payment systems focusing more on readmissions, we certainly know a lot of the readmissions in our hospitals are because, as you pointed out, we don't have appropriate places to discharge these folks where they can get appropriate care. So they end up either in, unfortunately, in the jail or in our hospitals. It also, part of the workforce challenge is we need to ensure we have safe places to work. And when I visit hospitals, I hear all the time that a lot of our safety issues are because we've got behavioral health patients that are boarding in our hospitals because they're not appropriately placed in the community. So you know, I would say it's all, it is right up from an advocacy standpoint. It's right up there with all those other issues when I talk to CEOs and folks like yourself. So really we have worked hard over the last several sessions with a broad array of stakeholders. Obviously there are a lot of folks that in this area to really talk about to the legislature about the resources, and it's a lot of different things, right? It's crisis services in a lot of cases to deal with those immediate situations. But obviously the state beds are important, and you're right, we had closed a lot of those, and now the legislature is starting to make investments in additional state beds. I know one of the challenges in Central Texas is you guys kind of aren't yet on the list, which is a challenge. I hear from you and your colleagues in that area all the time, but it's certainly something we're continuing to message on. And then just even putting money into purchase of private beds, because we also know there are a lot of facilities that do have private beds available as well. And then there's, you know, there are some crazy, you know, rules that we ought to deal with. I know that the IMD issue, which you all have worked on for many years, the fact that we can't cover Medicaid patients with behavioral health conditions, you know, beyond a couple weeks is ridiculous. We ought to have parity with, what we do on the private side. So really, it's just continue to advocate on all those things. And it doesn't do us any good to build a bunch of capacity if we don't have the workforce.
That's right.
So yeah. I think you're seeing a lot of the workforce investment has actually been targeted for behavioral health and even rural communities as well. And I would add too, I think one of the positives of COVID is some of the advancements we made in telehealth, and behavioral health is
an
opportunity there for telehealth to help with some of these shortage areas.
No, you're right. Well, and you touched on something that combines two of the topics we've talked about: workforce, behavioral health, so workplace violence. And I've been doing this for 36 years now, and I know in the beginning of my career, you didn't even think about somebody getting injured in the hospital setting intentionally. And, you know, unfortunately, we've had shootings, we've had stabbings, we've had all this stuff. But on a, unfortunately, incredibly regular basis, we have healthcare workers who are assaulted in their various venues of care. So talk a little bit about that. You know, what's THA been? What's your position and advocacy point with the state legislature in and around workforce violence?
Yeah. So, you know, a couple things there. I mean, one is, you know, we want to deal with making sure we've got community resources to deal with whomever. I mean, one of the things we talk to the legislature about, a lot of times I think they say, well, we know these folks are either going to end up in jail or in the hospital, and the hospital's got to be, you know, better than a jail, right? And we're like, yes, but just because they're in the hospital doesn't mean we have the right medications or the right staff to deal with those individuals, or even security. So we've tried to do some education around that at the end of the day, you need to provide us resources where these folks are at the right level of care. And so that's part of it. And the other is actually we have a really good relationship with the Nurses Association and have worked with them really over the whole time I've been here at THA to really look jointly at ways to work on workplace violence. And so we've actually tweaked the workplace violence statute over the last couple of sessions to make sure we've got committees that deal with are able to deal with these issues on an ongoing basis, that have the appropriate clinical staff on, that we've got the both the proactive plans in place as well as the after action plans in place to make sure we're just dealing with individual incidents at the facility. And I think that's, it's not perfect. It's something we're going to continue to work on. But I think that relationship serves us well because we know that the clinical staff has an idea about the best way to deal with things, and our job is to translate that into making sure it can be operationalized at the hospital. I know you deal with those issues every day.
We certainly do.
That's the secret sauce, right?
We certainly do. Well, we only have a few minutes left, John, but I do want to touch on a topic that could be an episode unto itself, and that's healthcare access as a whole. And if I'm not mistaken, Texas continues to lead the country with hospital closures. So what kind of advice, what can we do to curtail that? And I mean, I hate to say, maybe in some areas it's not a bad thing, but maybe it requires a different level of care or a different type of care in the community. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So again, it's that's a lot of different things. You're right. That's a whole nother episode. And certainly the whole, we got through it the legislative session, then we had the whole situation with the Reconciliation Act up in D.C., and that potentially creates some challenges down the road. I think we were able to delay some of the more problematic provisions for a couple years. But no, we have to get our hands around, how do we provide coverage for folks, whether that's Medicaid or, the subsidies in the marketplace, which have been very important under the ACA. So I think, that's important. And I would agree, we've had lots of discussions about the viability of rural facilities. Congress actually passed a bill which allows them to go to a rural emergency hospital,
yeah,
which is
very familiar with that,
more of an outpatient model, but they still get protected on their as if they were still providing inpatient mm-hmm. care. So I think you're right. We need to be smart about folks, what the community can support, what's appropriate. Certainly, you guys, I know y'all work closely with all the hospitals in your surrounding area. And I think, we learned during COVID that when you guys are full, if you can't get discharged to those rural communities, particularly if people live in those areas, that can be a problem, in Waco.
Yeah. And there's a lot of intentionality around that because, I've been in six states in my career, and I am a native Texan and got back home as soon as I could. But, really found that I've always been a big advocate of healthcare is best delivered locally as much as you possibly can. And so making sure that our referring partners, whether it be a critical access hospital or just a smaller community hospital, we want to make sure that whenever we provide the care that's appropriate for in our facility, we make sure that we get the referrals back to those local areas. And it may be, back to their physical therapy clinic or their home health or their SNF or whatever. And so that's very appreciated by the smaller hospitals. Unfortunately, I think a lot of larger hospitals and systems don't really follow that rationale. We from a mission standpoint, that's something that we really try to invest in these smaller hospitals. You mentioned COVID. One of the things that we did, being a part of a large national system, we were privy to a lot of information and to a lot of resources, and so we started weekly calls with our smaller hospitals around us. And it wasn't, hey, send us your patients. It's like, what can we help you with? And here's some information that we received that maybe you haven't heard. And that was appreciated. But the great thing about that is we also created that commonality and that networking in between those hospitals. Some of them really didn't know each other because of the large catchment area that we have. And so that's really helped. And we continue those calls, not quite as frequently to this day. But that's been something, trying to prop up rural healthcare as much as we can. So, and I think, if more hospitals and systems did that, we'd be in a lot better place. So, John, it's been a real pleasure having you on. Got just a couple of seconds left. Give us some final thoughts and words from you as president and CEO of THA.
Well, I just hope folks will reach out to us whenever you've got an issue. I mean, I always, when I travel the state, my last question is always, what's keeping you up at night, and let us know, because we want to help you, whether it's a regulatory issue or if we need to get the legislature involved in state and federal, but certainly all of the clinical support we do as well. Just use us as a resource. But I appreciate what you guys are doing out in the real world, because it makes a huge difference. And you guys are really the linchpin of your community from a quality of life standpoint, not just the clinical care, but being a significant employer as well.
Well, thank you so much for that, John. And again, it's been a real pleasure having you on. Folks, John Hawkins, President and CEO of Texas Hospital Association. I hope you got a little bit better idea of what your state hospital associations do and can provide for you. So with that, I will say thank you for joining me on this episode of I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. And I look forward to seeing you next time. Take care.